Record, and I'm going to share it live on Facebook. Let me get that started.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Got it.
Page. Let's see.
So everybody work. Keep yourself muted except for when you ask a question. I'll even mute myself in a little bit. Let me see. Jack, what's the senior physics group doing and when in January? Jack Gaffey, I know you're on. You were here. Where'd he go to?
Here. Can you hear me now?
What's a senior physicist are doing?
Yes. On Wednesday, May 19th at 1 p.m., Jim Drake from the University of Maryland will give a talk about magnetic reconnection in space plasmids.
Sounds like it's worthwhile.
There is a link to the announcement on page 7 of Stardust.
Let me see, are there any other announcements for the good of the order?
I have one.
Okay. Vice President John.
Our Rita Sambruno, who is to be our speaker next month, had to travel at that time, but we found a speaker who will be Joe Pesky, who's connected, who's runs NRAO for NSF and is also at George Mason University. And he'll be talking about Monsters in the Universe, New Insight into Black Holes.
That sounds real interesting, John. Let me see, are either the Dunhams on? Yeah, there's David Dunham. David, do you have anything to tell us? I see Alan Boss is on from Carnegie. No, excuse me, that's Alan Roos. I can't read. Okay, that's not Alan Boss. Okay. Well, is there anything else before I mute myself and turn the meeting over to our vice president? Okay, I'm going to mute myself. I'm the noisiest person here anyway.
I could mute myself too, just in case.
26 children on board and 60 children died on the ship. Same. A picture showed the kid having a good time.
Okay, shall I start?
Yes, yeah, start.
Okay. Yeah. It's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker this meeting, Peter Driscoll. Let me introduce him this way. When you look at a picture of the surface from one of the rovers, the first word that comes to mind isn't lush. Peter Driscoll from the Carnegie Earth and Planets Laboratory will explain why the Earth and Mars are so different in that respect, despite being fairly similar in size and in distance from the sun. He's an expert on the interiors of the Earth and of other planets, including exoplanets, and including the dynamos that generate the magnetic fields of those planets and exoplanets that have magnetic fields. Those magnetic fields turn out to be crucial for understanding why Earth is lush and Mars. A bachelor's degree in physics and astronomy from Dickinson College, which happens actually to be the first college to be founded after the formation of the United States. He obtained an MS in physics from San Francisco State University, and then an MA in Earth and Planetary Sciences from Johns Hopkins University, and then a PhD in Earth and Planetary Sciences from Johns Hopkins University. You might not know that the Earth's magnetic field waxes and wanes, and that the magnetic poles drift relative to the Earth's spin axis. Dr. Driscoll's PhD thesis was on geomagnetic polarity reversals, the evolution of the Earth's core, and the conditions of the dynamo for dynamo action in the cores of terrestrial exoplanets. Dr. Driscoll.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, John. And thank you for the invitation. And it's too bad we're over Zoom, but you know, maybe we have a slightly bigger crowd, so that's good. So I'm gonna go through my talk and then we'll take questions at the end. Hopefully I'll end it so it's not too late. So like John said, I work on planetary magnetic fields, mostly on the Earth, but today, in the spirit of the astronomy club here, I'm gonna talk more broadly about sort of planetary magnetic fields and then at the end get into exoplanet magnetic fields, which is really a future field of research. We haven't really detected any directly yet. So let's see if I can go to my next slide here. Okay, here's the topics I'm gonna go through tonight. I'm gonna start with dynamo basics, just some observations of the solar system, basics of how you generate a magnetic field from a liquid metal. And then I'm gonna describe, spend a lot of time talking about how dynamos evolve, how planetary magnetic fields evolve over time, and focus on the Earth, because the Earth is the one we know the best, and I'll highlight some of my work on that. And then, as I alluded to at the end, I'll talk a little bit about detecting other planetary magnetic fields. So first, the motivation is, you know, why care about planetary magnetic fields? Well, they're a fascinating phenomenon. They're generated deep in the interior of the planet, where the material becomes a metal, where the electrons are free and they can swirl around and induce a current that generates a magnetic field. And then that magnetic field then permeates through the rocky or gaseous part of the planet, way out into space, potentially, and is basically continues until it's balanced by the solar wind. So you can see in this cartoon, this magnetosphere boundary, I don't know if you can see my mouse, but I'll try and outline it there, is the boundary between our the magnetic field and the solar wind pressure. And it's thought to be that boundary that influences atmospheric escape, especially early on in a planet's history, and that may determine whether it keeps its hydrogen and therefore its water. And you can also see that the magnetic field lines for a dipole tends to concentrate on the planetary surface near the poles, which is a nice feature because those field lines focus high energy radiation, electrons and protons, that would be harmful to life, you know, at more temperate climates. So there's a couple of features of the magnetic field that we think are important for habitability. There's many debates on that topic. I'm not gonna get into them here, but it's generally thought of one of those pillars of planetary habitability. So here's a sketch from a review a while ago now in 2007 about how magnetic shielding might work. So this is the shielding protection of the planetary atmosphere due to its own magnetic field. So on the left, you imagine you have a strong magnetic field that holds off the solar wind at great heights for the Earth. This is about 7 Earth radii. So it's way, way far above the atmosphere as you know it. And then you can imagine for a weaker magnetic field, that solar wind pushes down deeper into the atmosphere and can start to energize some of the particles in the atmosphere and potentially kick them out. And then if you have no magnetic field, then you can imagine the solar wind's interacting directly with the atmosphere itself, perhaps at the ionopause, which can drive even stronger escape. This is also somewhat of a highly debated topic. There are people on both sides of the debate, but this is the general picture that most of us have in mind. So now I'm going to give you a sense of how common magnetic fields are. And I always say that, you know, magnetic fields are ubiquitous, at least in the solar system. We don't know about beyond, but in the solar system alone, here I'm showing you on the left, the log of their strength, the strength of the magnetic field in nanotesla at the surface of the object. And then on the x-axis is the mass in Earth masses. So I've just labeled a couple objects here. Io and Europa have induced magnetic fields, so they don't really count. But Ganymede, Mercury, Earth, Uranus, Neptune, Saturn, Jupiter, and the Sun all generate magnetic fields today. Mars and the Moon, which is not on here, appears to have had a remnant magnetic field. So it had an active dynamo in its core in the past, but it's now dead. We're still trying to figure out exactly why. And on the right-hand side, I'm showing you sort of the zoo of magnetic field morphologies. Some magnetic fields are tilted more than others, other planets, and some even are less dipolar than the Earth. The Earth's field is very dipolar and it's tilted about 12 degrees. Saturn is an odd one. It's tilted about 0 degrees. So it looks like the magnetic field is the dipole axis is perfectly aligned with the rotation axis, at least to the point that we can measure it. And that makes it real hard to actually measure Saturn's rotation rate, because for the gaseous planets, it's one of the main ways we infer the rotation of the deep interior is by seeing the magnetic field rotate. Again, something I'm not going to get into in great detail here. So how are these magnetic fields generated? For that, we have to look a little deeper. And here's a cartoon of the rocky planets along the top and then the gaseous icy planets along the bottom to different scales, of course. So Mercury has an active dynamo, as I mentioned, a large core. Venus, which is about the size of the Earth, has no dynamo today, nor have we inferred one in the past. But the surface of Venus is so hot that it could just be, it had a magnetic field, but that remnant magnetization in the crust is now gone. For the Earth, we have an active dynamo today, and we know we've had one for about 3.5 billion years, perhaps more than 4 billion years, if you believe some of the older data from the zircons. So perhaps the Earth's magnetic field is as old as the planet itself. For the Moon, we know it had an early magnetic field that died. Same with Mars. And then Ganymede here on the far right is the only satellite we know of that is currently maintaining a dynamo today. That's the Moon of Jupiter. And these are all liquid iron swirling and convecting inside of these cores and generating a magnetic field that way. When you look to the gas planets, they all have magnetic fields, but they're generated instead by ionized hydrogen or other icy molecules in the case of Uranus and Neptune, or so we think. We think that hydrogen ionizes at certain depth. But, you know, just the same, it does produce very strong magnetic field. And it has for, probably 4 billion years. And at this point, I wanted to touch a little bit on some of the history of my department. So the department used to be called the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. We changed our name to the Earth and Planets Lab, just to keep up with the trends in the topics that are studied at the department. Just last year, we changed our name. But for the first 100 and some years of the department's life, we were known as the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, and we were focused on measuring just that terrestrial magnetism and understanding where it came from. And then in 1955, two astronomers at DTM, Ken Franklin and Bernard Burke, made an accidental discovery. There were radio astronomers, looking for some extragalactic source, and they went out and built their own radio telescope and this is called the Mills Cross Array in Seneca, Maryland, which is not far from DC. It's about 20 minutes up River Road, if you know where that is. And basically they put out these poles, spaced out these poles in a cornfield, strung electrical wires across it in a very particular pattern. You can't see well in this aerial footage, but there's a big cross here. And that's just to create a big baseline to collect really long wave radio radiation. And so it's not a typical telescope that you can turn or anything. It's just kind of sitting there, kind of like Arecibo, looking straight up at all times. And in 1955, they published this now famous paper of a radio source that they tracked down to the planet Jupiter. At the time, Jupiter was not known whether Jupiter had a magnetic field, but they proposed in this 1955 paper and were later found to be correct that the radio waves they were detecting were being emitted by electrons orbiting Jupiter's magnetic field lines. And that's called electron cyclotron emission. And we're going to come back to that at the very end. And then there's this, there's still a plaque up there along the site of the detections, the discovery site. But I was there a couple of years ago, and now it's a shooting range. So not a shooting range, but an area that's for hunting, seasonal hunting. So you have to be careful if you want to go wandering around back there. And so here's a, this is an image of Jupiter in rotation, and then overlaid on top of it is this cartoon of the radio emission coming from the poles. The radio emission typically comes from the poles because that's where the magnetic field lines are most dense. And so the electrons propagate down and emit their radiation back into space. Okay, so that was in 1955. And that was the first planetary magnetic field that was detected, and that was on Jupiter. But of course, we've known about, humans have known about Earth's magnetic field for millennia, going back, I think the oldest is in China, thousands of years ago, they had the rudimentary compasses. But in the European history books, they're dated back to about the 16th century, when maps were being made by mariners that realized when they took their compass out to see that when they, sometimes the magnetic field would change when they got near a mountain or a volcanic edifice. And so it was thought at the time that the magnetic field of the Earth was actually generated by big magnetic mountains. And so this famous map by Mercator in 1560 placed a giant black mountain, Rupes Nigra, at the North Pole. And, you know, of course it had never been seen, it doesn't exist, but this was like at the time what the, some of the ideas were. And then William Gilbert came along and really modernized the field of geomagnetism in 1600 when he wrote this massive tome called De Magnete, which is half philosophy, you know, half real philosophy, half natural philosophy. But he did a number of experiments on magnetic fields in the lab, built his own little miniature magnetic earth and did demonstrations, and actually had this sketch in the manuscript where he predicted that the Earth's magnetic field should follow this particular, you know, that the compass should point in these directions. If you're near the North Pole here on the right, that the field should point down, and the South Pole should point up and tilt it in. And this is exactly what you would expect for a dipole field. So he was right on the nose with this. And here I've just got a sketch of a dipole field just rotated on its side, of course. And so that was really, at that point, it really picked up, and research on the magnetic field became more popular, and people around Europe started to set up magnetic observatories to measure just how, where the magnetic field was pointing locally. And then Gauss came along and actually started to measure, came up with a way of measuring the intensity of the magnetic field for how much magnetic force it put on your magnetic needle. And then these other magnetic observatories, all these little dots here, going back about 150 years, show that the intensity of the Earth's magnetic field has been decaying, not decaying, but decreasing rather quickly, at least on this scale. And the red line here is to show you the free decay. So if the core were to completely stop moving and the magnetic field were just to decay on its own and just die, it would follow that red line. So this rapid decrease along this black line tells you that there's something else causing the decay, the decrease in the magnetic field intensity. And that is just, what that is just the natural fluctuation in induction in the core. And not to worry, this is not going to zero anytime soon. You know, the bottom of the scale is still an enormously large number. And here on the right, you're seeing the path of the magnetic pole, the North Magnetic Pole, now mapped out from much more recent data. So you can see this goes back about 150 years again. And the North Pole, North Magnetic Pole just kind of wanders. It never stays in one position very long. It changes, you know, every 10, 20 years or so. You have to put a new point on there. You have to remake your magnetic maps. But it also doesn't stay at the pole, right? It kind of wanders around. Okay. Now, if you want to look further back in time than the 1850s, you need to go look in rocks. So if you have a volcanic rock that erupts very, and it's very hot, as it starts to cool, it'll form magnetic minerals, iron oxides and iron sulfides, so these gray grains here are. And initially, when the rock is hot, those little magnetic grains will have random orientation. They always have some magnetic orientation. They have some internal magnetic moment. And if there's some applied external field like the Earth's magnetic field, then they will start to rotate into that magnetic field as they cool down. So as it cools down, those minerals start to settle and those little vectors start to settle down and they take on the ambient magnetic field. And you can imagine if the magnetic field is pointing in a different direction, say it was reversed, then that rock would retain the record of that new direction. And so if you've got a volcano and it's erupting every million years or so, you may see one layer of the magma or the rock is directed one direction and the other layer is directed another direction. So this is paleomagnetism. This is a basic introduction to paleomagnetism. So not only is the Earth's magnetic field changing, but you need to consider where you are on the Earth. So if you have a simple dipole field, the magnetic field at the North Pole, as you would expect, would be pointing directly down, and at the South Pole, directly up. If you're standing on the South Pole. And then at the equator, of course, it'd be horizontal and so forth. So you have to take this into account when you're measuring where the magnetic pole is. You can also look at old rocks and infer what latitude they were at, assuming the Earth's magnetic field was a dipole at the time. And that's called paleogeography. So that's reconstructing the positions of the continents using these magnetic minerals. So the most famous historical example of these of magnetic rocks, it was discovered in the late 40s, right after World War II, and in the early 50s, when they were dragging these deep toe magnetometers off of the back of naval ships looking for submarines. And they came back and they looked at the data that the magnetometers had recorded and they saw all these wiggles what the magnetometer was recording. They were very faint wiggles, but in fact, what they were recording was these so-called magnetic seafloor stripes. So this is the best record we have of Earth's magnetic reversal record. And this is because the seafloor along the Atlantic, mid-Atlantic ridge. So in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a big line of volcanoes that stretches the entire way up the Atlantic Ocean. And it erupts continuously and spreads slowly. And every time you get an eruption, that magma locks in that local field direction and then solidifies and then moves away. And that's what this coloring here is. The gray and the white are different directions of the magnetic field. And you could put together this, this magnetic stripe map from compare it from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, and you see the same patterns. So the width of each of these stripes indicates the length of time between a reversal. And the length of time between a reversal is not normal, it's random. And so it's almost like a randomly generated, like a barcode. And so the people back in the 60s put together these barcodes from the seafloor and realized the continents were moving. And that was sort of the beginning of plate tectonics, modern geophysics as we know it. Here's a zoomed in portion. The last 2 million years, this is a much more modern record here. But in this graph, I'm identifying the two ways that we have of probing the Earth's magnetic field. And that is by looking first at its intensity. That's the red, that's this really jagged red curve here. This is the intensity of the Earth's magnetic field as measured in the seafloor over the last 2 million years. This is many different records put together. And then on the top, you see the current magnetic cron is called the Bruins Age. So we've been in the same polarity for about 780,000 years. And back then there was a reversal, the Bruins-Matayama reversal event. And before that, we were in a stable cron for about 200,000 years and so forth. And the Earth's magnetic field reverses about four or five times per million years on average for the last couple million years. But if you look back even further, you can see some interesting trends. So here is reversal rate over the last 550 million years. So now most of this data must come from rocks, from really old, well-preserved rocks. And you can see the reversal rate, which is now about four or five reversed per million years, decreased slowly as you go back to about 80 million years ago. And then there were no reversals during this anomalous period known as the Cretaceous Normal Supercron between 80 and 140 million years ago. And then the reversals pick back up and then they go back down and there's another supercron and so forth. So it looks like there's like an oscillation in the reversal frequency, but this is not a core time scale, this periodicity of 100, 200 million years, because the core time scale is more like a year or a decade. This is more of a mantle convection time scale. The mantle convects very slowly. So we think this is evidence for the influence that the mantle has on the cooling rate of the core. Okay. So getting back to our planetary magnetic field observations, I'm going to zoom back out now. Nearly all large solar system objects have magnetic fields of their own, as do some smaller objects. And the reason why they're so ubiquitous is you only need three things. You need one, a large electrically conducting fluid. So it can be iron, it can be hydrogen. You need an energy supply to drive convection. This is actually the hardest component. And three, you need planetary rotation, which is also ubiquitous. Everything rotates. So I'm going to focus on the next couple of slides on this second point here, this energy supply, this convection. And here is how I see the field of dynamo theory at large, how we understand magnetic fields, is on one hand, we've got observations, satellites, rocks, modern space probes. On the other hand, we have actual theory, MHD theory. We have laboratory experiments on rotating fluids. We have numerical simulations of dynamos, which I'm going to show you towards the end. And then to put these two end members together, you make these applied models, planetary models, where you have to consider, okay, how much heat is the planet losing? What are its material properties? How do they behave? And what is causing the buoyancy, the convection in the core to occur at all? And so you have to do all of this effectively to really understand how magnetic fields works. But nobody does all of this stuff. So everybody does a little bit. I do mostly modeling and simulations, as I'll show you towards the end. Okay, so in a real basic sense, how does fluid motion generate a magnetic field? Well, you can imagine if you have a charged particle and you put it in motion, you will generate a magnetic field. But instead of a particle, you actually have a fluid, and that fluid is not only convecting, but since the planet is rotating, the convection sets up these large vortices that are rotationally aligned with the rotation axis, almost like a tornado or a hurricane, but they're very tall and skinny. And that those vortices help organize the magnetic field lines into these poloidal field lines that we see on the surface that generate the dipole field. And here is an equatorial, looking down into the equatorial plane of a simulation, just to give you a sense of what the magnetic field looks like over the course of several thousand years, you know, red being positive, blue being negative, is you've got this swirling mixture of fluid, of metal, liquid metal, and it's generating this very complicated magnetic field. We don't see all of that at the surface, and we can't see in the core, but we see the magnetic field on the surface, and we can infer that there are processes like this generating it. Okay, so there's basically two types of ways of generating the fluid motion, generating the convection in the core. There's typical thermal convection. So you can imagine you're cooling your planet down over time. So it starts very hot and it just cools down very slowly. And the mantle above the core, which is made of silicates, convects very slowly, like I said, has a very poor conductivity. So it controls the cooling of the core and cools it very slowly. And on the other hand, if you cool the core down enough, the iron will start to solidify. And we know that has happened in the Earth. We know the Earth has an inner core at its center. That's solid iron, mostly solid, or fully solid, mostly pure iron. And as that solidifies, that releases some energy at the base of the liquid outer core that also drives convection. So on the Earth, we think we have this combined thermochemical convection driving the fluid. And recently I come up with this concept to help understand how does the cooling rate of a planet influence the magnetic field? And so I call it the Goldilocks cooling rate, which you'll understand here in a second. So you can imagine if you have a very slowly cooling planet, so Q here being the heat flow coming off the core mantle boundary, QCMB. If you have a very slowly cooling planet, then the magnetic field may initially be strong, but it will eventually die out because there's not enough convection occurring in the planet. You have to have cooling to drive convection. If you have a medium heat flow, then you can drive that thermal convection for a little while. And then at some point, the inner core will grow and that'll drive compositional convection. And so maybe you get a new regime, sort of a boost in the magnetic field intensity, like the Earth, we think. And then if you're cooling too fast, so your planet gets really cold, you can imagine you have a little dynamo to begin with, but then the inner core gets so big that it freezes out the whole core, and that's gonna kill the dynamo because you need a liquid. So if you have a solid core, the dynamo is gonna die. And this may be what happened on the Earth's moon. The magnetic record shows signs of looking something like this. And so the energy you have to drive the dynamo here, I write as Q dyne, and that's equal to the core mantle boundary heat flow minus this Q sub K, which is the conductive heat flow. So the heat that the mantle is pulling out of the core can escape by two ways. It can be conducted through the core. So that's just one atom knocking into another atom, knocking into another atom, transporting the heat conductively. So the fluid's not moving. The convective portion is when there's so much heat that the fluid actually wants to move. So this is like boiling water. Once the water's boiling, then you're driving that convection because you've got such a big heat source beneath it. And one of the recent paradoxes in the field of the core is it has to do with the conductivity. So if this conductivity term gets very large, and you can imagine the energy you have to drive the dynamo gets very small. And that has actually happened recently, I say recently in the last 10 years, and that's because people have finally been able to measure the conductivity, the thermal and electrical conductivity, K and sigma, of iron at core conditions, so high temperature, high pressure. And the initial estimates were like 30, 40 watt per meter per Kelvin. Those were sort of theoretical estimates. But then when the experiments came along in 2011, 2012, they found a factor of two or three higher thermal and electrical conductivity, which meant that the core all of a sudden doesn't have all that convective energy that we thought it did. And so this caused a big paradox in the community, and we're still dealing with it today. And here's just a timeline of published conductivities. And initially they were kind of really bouncing around, but now it seems like folks have settled around 170 to 100 watt per meter per Kelvin, which is sort of what we use in our models to make sure we can reproduce the Earth. And here I'm showing the conductivity now, the electrical conductivity versus the temperature in the core. And this black line is sort of what we think the Earth's electric conductivity, given its material makeup, what we think its electrical conductivity is a function of temperature. So you can imagine the core is initially hot, and then as the core cools down, it tracks along this line. And today we're somewhere around 4,000 Kelvin at the core mantle boundary. When the core crossed about 4,100 Kelvin at the core mantle boundary, that was when we think the inner core nucleated. So we would have transitioned from a purely thermal dynamo early on to now having this compositional source additional to that. But you can see in the top right here, there's this gray wedge where you don't have a dynamo. And that would be because the thermal conductivity is so high, you don't have any of that convective energy left. So if we're wrong about this black curve here, or if I'm wrong about this gray line here, and the Earth has actually passed through this gray region at some point in its history, then you would expect the dynamo to have died at some point perhaps, which we'll come back to with some of the more detailed modeling towards the end. And here I've drawn a the same kind of plot, core electrical conductivity versus temperature, but now I've moved the lines around to give you a sense of what another planet might be like with a different composition. So if you increase the mantle viscosity, then that pushes this, it expands this no dynamo region. And if you increase the core conductivity, it moves you this black line up. So you can imagine if this is someone like somewhat like Venus, perhaps, then Venus maybe had a magnetic field early on, but then it died and it's probably still dead today. It could potentially kick on again in the future. Mars as well, you know, hypothetically. Okay, so how well do we understand understand the geodynamo evolution? Do we see any of these things? Do we see the dynamo die? What do we predict? What does the data look like? So here's, these dots here are paleomagnetic intensities from rocks going back from 0 to 2,000 million years ago. So that's 2 billion years ago, 0 to 2 billion years ago. And I'm focusing in on this time range because we think the inner core probably first nucleated somewhere in this time frame. So some of the big questions are, what is the predicted geomagnetic field history? And was it always a dipole? And did it ever die? So you can see here, we've got real good data over the last 500 million years or so. That's the Phanerozoic. It's very scattered. So the intensity of the field fluctuates by factors of, you know, 4 or 5 naturally. This black line here is an average. So you can see the average is sort of flat. And then when we go back to the Neoproterozoic between 500 and 1,000 million years ago, we have very few intensity data points, which is something that I've recently questioned the observers to go back and try and fill in this data. And then if you go back even further, we've got scattered data. So, you know, we find a good rock, good well-preserved rock unit, and we get a bunch of data points. So you get this kind of vertical striping in the data. But when you look at this, kind of squint your eyes and step back, it looks flat to me. It doesn't have any kind of trend that you might expect for 2 billion years of evolution. All right, so the number one thing you might want to search for is the actual nucleation event of the inner core, because you expect that to be a first order change in the structure and the energetics of the core. So when did the inner core form? Did it affect the dynamo? Is there a paleomagnetic signature of that event? If we could pin these things down, if we could pin down where in this record where the inner core nucleated, then we could have a temperature at the center of the Earth at a given time, which is, would be a really unique data point, you know, that geophysicists would just die for. So this is part of what I'm doing now, is trying to track this down the last couple of years. Still don't have a definitive answer, but we're moving in the right direction. And so in order to make this prediction about when the inner core nucleated and what it might look like, I start with some constraints. So we know that the heat coming out of the Earth, we know the mantle temperature today, we know the inner core size today from seismology, and we know the dynamo's been alive for almost Earth's entire history. So I put these physical constraints into a cooling model, and I get a prediction for when the inner core nucleated, and that prediction is about 650 million years ago, plus or minus 50 million years. Big uncertainties because there's a number of material properties we don't know all that well. But over here on the right, I'm showing you the predicted dipole moment from my model, and then it's thermal dynamo, and then at about 650 million years ago, you see this big kink and jump up, and that's due to the inner core nucleation. This red line here is inner core size. And in these gray circles in the background are the paleointensities I showed you on the last slide. So you don't really, there's not really much agreement here. We've sort of known this for a while now, that the paleointensities don't look like the dipole moment predictions from the theory. So I decided to take a different look at this. What I did was I decided to use evolving numerical dynamos. So I take my energy history from my thermal evolution model and I stick it into a three-dimensional MHD model. And I change the boundary conditions every 20 million years or so, or 50 million years. I'll change the boundary conditions. So I'm kind of marching through time to see what it does to the dynamo. And first, I need to mention a caveat with these numerical dynamos that I work with is that they're very complicated. They're very hard to run. So you've got what you're computing is a spherical shell. So you're not computing in the inner core. So just in the shell part. And you grid it. You make it lots of little grid points. And you're tracking the fluid velocity, the temperature, the magnetic field intensity at all these grid points. And the whole thing is rotating, of course. And there's coupled equations to drive magnetic field generation. And so because it's so complicated, you can only use, you can only make your model so realistic, let's put it that way. And the choice we normally make is to slow the rotation rate down. And so most of the simulations are down here in this green box. So on the x-axis, I have the Ekman number, which is a dimensionless form of the rotation rate being omega. And the Earth's rotation rate is actually like 10 to the minus 14, 10 to the minus 15 in these units. So we're about 10 orders of magnitude in rotation rate. And in Rayleigh number, this is the cooling rate, the dimensionless cooling rate. So higher Rayleigh number means increased convection. So even though our simulations are way down here in the green box and the Earth is up here in this blue box, we think that there is this black dashed curve. It's known as dynamic similarity in fluid dynamics, where you can reproduce some, you know, some fluid dynamical phenomenon at a different scale if you get these dimensionless parameters correct. And so people are now working and marching along this black dashed line to see if, in fact, all what we think holds actually holds as we go towards the Earth. And so far, we've made good progress along with that. Okay, so that's my caveat. All right, so here's an example of one of my dynamo simulations. You're looking from the side, a cut wedge through the side at the temperature field on the right and the magnetic field that's generated by the convection on the left. So you can see the inner core is very hot and you have these sort of plume features coming off, especially if you look in the equatorial plane, you get these plumes that come off and then they're kind of ephemeral and they diffuse back into the field. And this, as the fluid rotates in the equatorial plane and generates these vortices, it tends to generate magnetic field lines that then, you know, travel all the way up to the Earth's surface and so forth. So that just gives you a sense of what the models look like. So now I'm going to show you my evolving models. Okay. So here's the grand result of this model that I wanted to focus on today. Here's the dipole intensity as predicted by my models over the last 2 billion years. Each big circle just denotes a model. And the black filled circle inside of it shows you the size of the inner core. So present day, I've got, you know, I grow the inner core to the present day inner core size. And then back 700 million years ago, there was no inner core in my model, okay? And I'm also changing the heat flow and all these other things. So the model starts the present day, it's very Earth-like. I've sort of calibrated it to be there, to be Earth-like. And as you go back 500 million years, not much happens, it's pretty flat, kind of like the paleomagnetic record. But right before the inner core nucleates, the field is predicted to be very weak, in this very weak state. And then prior to a billion years ago, my model finds that it should be back, jump back up into a strong field state. And before that, into a strong multipolar state. And I'm not going to go into what all of these things mean, but I'll just give you some sense of what it looks like. So here's the present day equatorial temperature. So you can see there's a big inner core, sharp temperature gradients in the inner boundary, a very dipolar surface magnetic field. As you go back to right after the inner core nucleates, see it's very tiny here. And you tend to get one strong plume coming off the inner core. But again, a very dipolar field, although the intensity is a bit weaker. And then prior to the inner core, you can see there is a sort of a tiny little inner core in the model just because you can't resolve the model at the origin. But the boundary conditions are completely passive, so they're not influencing the flow. And you can see these temperature gradients are now concentrated towards the outer boundary. So this is a purely thermal dynamo at this point. There's no compositional convection. And the magnetic field morphology is no longer dipolar. You can see it's got these weird quadrupolar lobes and features. And it's very time variable. So here I'm showing you a movie of the modern day this is a couple thousand years of my modern day model. So it's very dipolar. It's kind of wiggling, but it's stable, it's dipolar. And then prior to the inner core nucleating, it's not dipolar at all. It's just kind of this quadrupolar, octopolar, very modular field. So you can imagine if you're measuring rocks on an Earth with a magnetic field like this, its directions are going to be crazy. Okay, it's going to look like the continents are like moving in crazy directions and things like that. So here's just a comparison. This is a very busy plot, but I'm overlaying on top of the paleointensity data and the time average of the paleointensity data in black, my evolving dynamo model in light green, which predicts this stable field and then a drop and then an increase and a stable field again. So really the place to focus on is this Neoproterozoic era, 500 to a billion years ago. This is when I predict the field to be really weird. And recently some people are starting to focus on this and see what's going on there. There's some other interesting geophysical phenomenon during this period that is these very rapid plate motions. So it looks like Africa and South America were jumping, or, you know, relatively moving an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude faster than they should be, which has been attributed to rapid, what's it called? True polar wander. So I think the whole lithosphere was rotating instead of just the continents moving around. And also back around 850 million years ago, people think they see evidence for a snowball Earth, which I've also put some question marks on, because they see continents that their paleo latitudes put them near the pole, but they have tropical deposits in the rocks and so forth. And they also have what look like equatorial paleo latitudes with glacial features. And that's when they think there's snowball events. But if the magnetic field is not dipolar at the time, as I depicted here, then those paleo latitudes are going to be off. And so what you think is an equatorial glacier could be a mid-latitude glacier, and it might not be real. So that's in my 2019 paper. So the takeaway is being that dynamo evolution need not be a simple monotonic thing. And like solar dynamos, planetary dynamos might go through phases, not like a regular 11-year solar cycle. Obviously, we don't see that. But they evolve through long-term phases. They could start in a dipole and go through a quadrupole, or go through a weak field and end up dying eventually at some point. So, okay, and this is my last bit. Just a couple more minutes here on exoplanets, because this is kind of the hot topic now. So what about exoplanets? We don't know much. Obviously, we don't know much about their interior. All we have is observations of their mass and their radius, which gives you their bulk density, if you're lucky. And here's a smattering of exoplanets. This plot's a bit old, where we think we've got some planets that have the right density to be Earth-like, in the sense that they'll have a silicate mantle and an iron-rich core. But what we don't know is their thermal state. We want to know, are they habitable? And one of those things is, does it have a magnetic field? And to generate a magnetic field, it has to have a large iron core that's convecting. And so we're trying to get at all of these questions with just such little data. So it's very difficult to do. We've started putting out some very theoretical papers, and I'm not going to go through this. This is from 2 years ago now, where we looked at different size cores and different mass planets. And we found that the super Earths, after they form, are likely to be much hotter, retain their heat much longer than the smaller Earth mass planets. And so these super Earths might not nucleate an inner core, you know, within the first 4 billion, 5 billion years. So it could be that they have a thermal dynamo that dies, kind of like Mars and Venus did, and that Earth, you know, and then Earth, because of the inner core, may have actually saved it. But like I said, there's a lot of parameters to play with here. And so I want to end with the potential detectability of these objects, because this will really give us some constraints instead of just kind of walking around in the dark here. And the strategy is to go back to that Franklin and Burke detection of Jupiter, And to use the magnetic emissions, electron cyclotron emissions from the aurora near the poles of these planets. And I've already sort of explained this a little bit, that you have these electrons being trapped around the magnetic field.
The other one's cool. It has some in it.
Someone's got their mic on, I think. So here's my prediction back from my thesis back in 2011. Prediction for magnetic field emission, radio emissions from exoplanets around Alpha Centauri, GJ876, and a smattering of other exoplanets that were known at the time. So on the x-axis here is the radio power in Jansky's, and the x, and that was the y-axis, and the x-axis